President, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps you may wonder why I couple those two phrases in my title, Evolution and Human Destiny. A scientific study on the one hand, and an attitude or theological concept, if you like, on the other. For the very simple reason that knowledge affects our attitude, and facts affect our concepts, our basic ideological and even religious doctrine. What we, it seems to me, need in the Western world now is some new comprehensive ideology with a strong religious element in it, or if you like, a new religion, or if you like, a new component in existing religions, some body of ideas which will have a directive action, a directive force on our minds and on our actions. Now, I obviously haven't got time to go into a great many biological details, but I would remind you that there have been two great scientific revolutions, major ones. First of all, the one dealing with physical and chemical matters only, initiated by Galileo and especially by Newton, which brought order into the physical and physico-chemical world. And then what we may call the Darwinian or biological revolution, which brought order and sense into the world of life. I have little doubt that these will be followed by a third revolution, of which we see the incipient signs, the psychological revolution, bringing order and comprehension into the world of mind, but that is only beginning. Now, the great point, I think, now, that we may say about the Darwinian or biological revolution is that we can see that not merely life, but the entire reality, the entire cosmos, all of reality is really best looked at as a process of change and transformation which has various aspects. Perhaps it is simplest to call it all evolution, though that may be confusing semantically. At any rate, that process has three very distinct aspects or phases, though one grows out of the other. First of all, there is the aspect of the non-living, the physico-chemical process, as revealed in the evolution of the cosmos as a whole, of nebulae and galaxies, stars, solar systems. I can't spend much time over that. I would merely remind you that that occurs on a scale so vast, both in space and time, as to be almost beyond our range of comprehension, that it is exceedingly slow in its operations, and that it never gets matter to any high level of organization. Normally, almost all the matter in the cosmos and lifeless matter is at an extremely low level of organization, very rarely above even the atomic level, sometimes to simple molecules, and here and there must have got to the stage of organic molecules. Then we have the biological phase or level, of which we only know anything on this Earth. It is on the theory of probability, likely that there may be a few other planets, a few stars somewhere in our galaxy or elsewhere, in which something analogous or identical with our type of life has evolved. We know nothing about it. Biological evolution has a different method. Come back to that in a minute, the method of natural selection, instead of the slow methods of aggregation and interaction. It will operate much faster. Instead of taking instead of taking tens or hundreds of billions of years to get anywhere, it gets somewhere in tens and hundreds of millions of years. And it's comparatively slow compared to ours, but very fast compared to cosmic evolution. And it does produce extremely high levels of organization. It turns the stuff of the world into objects which, if they were not so familiar, we should all regard as miracles. Dogs and horses and flowering plants and so on. They are almost incredibly complicated if you reflect that they have been brought about by the automatic processes of reproduction and natural selection. The sphere of life is a very limited one. It's that thin skin on the surface of our small planet, which usually goes by the name of the biosphere, the sphere of life. Then finally, again, so far as we know only on this planet, there is the level, an aspect of human evolution. That again has totally new methods. In addition to aggregation, in addition to selection, it has the method of handing down and altering tradition, to use the most general term. And therefore, you can profit from human things, you can profit by experience, your own experience and that of your fellows, which is impossible for other forms of life. And in accordance with that, the whole process has gone very much faster. The whole process of human evolution is of the order of 1 million years as opposed to 1 billion years, and it's gone faster and faster in an accelerating, cumulative way up to the present. Now, I'd just like to say a word about the course of evolution. That was hardly known to Darwin at all. He just knew there were fossils, but nobody had worked out the detailed sequence of fossils in any one period, much less over the whole world. Now, largely thanks to your American paleontologist, a great deal is known of the actual course of evolution, not for the whole period of the billion years of life, but for the last half of it, 500 million years. Now, of course, the most salient fact about it is that as you go back in time, you find that certain types of life cease to be present in the world. If you go back quite a short time, there were no human beings. If you go back a little further, you find there were no warm-blooded animals, either mammals or birds. If you go back rather further, you find there were no land vertebrates. Go back a little further than that, you find there were no flowering plants. A little further than that again, there were no land animals at all, and no land plants, and then no marine vertebrates, so you get down to a much more primitive form. There has been a succession of new types appearing in evolution, and it is, on any common sense view, and on any, I think, scientific view, clear that the higher level, however you define high, the higher level of organization reached by life has tended to go up during evolution. On the other hand, you don't necessarily have constant change and improvement in all branches of life. The general tendency is this, that when a new group arrives on the scene, it tends to break up relatively rapidly, because all these geological processes are very slow, into a number of types adapted to different modes of life. Then each of those tends to specialize, not quite so speedily, but rather steady rate, to get more and more adapted to that particular way of life, like, for instance, the horse stock gradually getting more and more adapted to eating grasses and to running fast on open plains. And then that is almost invariably followed by a period of stability. Natural selection has got to a dead end. Natural selection can't push it any further. It can't. One of the great things with horses was the reduction of the number of toes, helping them to run faster. Well, obviously you can't get increased speed by reducing the number of toes below one per foot. We've got to a dead end in that particular process. And there are many other obvious dead ends of what I may call a biomechanical nature, which confront life when it's got into one of these lines of specialization. So that stability, as well as change, is a frequent feature of life. You may also get specialization to a degenerate form of life, going backwards, as it were. Then there is also, at every level, there's a sort of playing of variations on a theme, in the throwing off of different species, since they're separate species, which are adapted to this or that habitat within the general mode of life. For instance, there are, of the genus Drosophila, the famous fruit fly, they've already described over 600 distinct species, each of them an interbreeding unit. Then of course there's another change, a rather drastic one. You may get total extinction of either most of a group or the whole of a group. All the giant reptiles of the secondary epoch have now become wiped out. You may get one group, one line among one group, giving rise to a new important group, which then repeats the process. The most significant, for us at any rate, change of that sort was when the one line among the reptiles gave rise to the very primitive early mammals, which then broke up into all the different types of mammals we know today. And in most such cases where a group gives rise to a wholly new group, you can say that there has been a real improvement in the general level of the second, the later group, over the earlier one. For instance, take an obvious example, mammals are just pieces of biological machinery, superior to reptiles in two obvious ways. One, that they can regulate their temperature constant, make it keep it constant, and the other, that they look after their young in a very much more efficient way, both before and after birth. Now, finally, there are some, if you take this point about one group producing a new one, you find that some major groups come to a dead end. Birds apparently cannot go any further. They've got their wings so specialized for flying that they've got to the highest pitch they can ever get. They're flying organisms and they can't go back and do something else. But there is a general line which has run through the whole of life, which can, I think, properly be called progress, in the sense that it has shown a constant improvement in various basic properties. And those basic properties, it's rather difficult to define general properties. One of them is a general control over the environment. Animals are bigger and more powerful, able to utilize, get their food better, and so forth and so on. Another is a relative independence of environment, of which the changes in the environment, of which this question of temperature control is a very good one. A mammal is much more independent of outside temperature than a reptile, whose whole bodily activities go up and down with the external temperature. And then there's general improvement in what you might call internal regulation, internal harmony, the way in which the different glands of the body and higher vertebrates work together, the way in which the nervous system regulates and controls all the activity, that sort of thing. Finally, there are some extremely interesting points, and that is that there has been an improvement, very notable, in the organs for acquiring knowledge about the outer world, the sense organs and then the brain to use that knowledge. The lowest forms of life don't have any special sense organs at all. You can trace the evolution throughout life of better light perceiving, sound perceiving, and so on, sense organs, and then of the development of the brain that utilize the information. And finally, an interesting point, and it's not only, as a matter of fact, it's not only in regard to knowledge, but actually other qualities, mental or psychological qualities as well. It's difficult to talk about feeling or will or perception in a creature like an amoeba or a jellyfish, but it's impossible really not to believe that those faculties are present in a higher mammal like a dog or a horse. Now, I just want to correct one or two misapprehensions. This progress, whatever you like to call it, I think it's fair to call it progress, that you see in biology, is not inevitable and not universal. As a matter of fact, it's restricted to quite a few lines, always has been, and the restriction gets more and more complete. And secondly, it's by no means inevitable, well, because many lines don't show it. Another aspect of recent new knowledge, which I think is important for our purpose, is this, namely that in the last, shall we say, 50 years or so, there's been an immense opening up backwards of human history. Instead of going back, as your ancestors did, and my ancestors, at the time of the American Revolution, they went as far back as ancient Rome and Greece. That's about as far back as they got. Well, now we trace history much further back, 4000 BC. Before that, we've got proto-history, and we've got prehistoric archaeology, and we've got that all linked up with primitive map of prehistoric man, right back to the cave paintings, and far beyond that to the sub-men half a million and more years ago.